there. Thanks for listening to Let's Talk Withdrawal, a weekly discussion on antidepressants and the issues surrounding them.
Hello, my name is James, and welcome to episode 7 of Let's Talk Withdrawal, a new weekly podcast discussing antidepressants. A little later on, I'll be going through some of your feedback. Thanks so much for getting in touch. Please keep your messages coming. I love hearing from you. This week, we have an interview with Dr. David Healy, who is an internationally respected psychiatrist, psychopharmacologist, scientist, and author. A professor of psychiatry in Wales, David studied medicine in Dublin and at Cambridge University. He is a former secretary of the British Association for Psychopharmacology and has authored more than 200 peer-reviewed articles and 20 books, including The Antidepressant Era and The Creation of Psychopharmacology. David's latest book, Pharmageddon, documents the riveting and terrifying story of how pharmaceutical companies have hijacked healthcare in America and the life-threatening results. David is a founder and CEO of Data-Based Medicine Limited, which operates through its website risk.org and is dedicated to making medicine safer through online direct patient reporting of drug side effects. I was keen to ask Dr. Healy for his views on prescribing practice, medicine safety, and the effectiveness of pharmaceutical regulation. Thank you so much for talking to us, Dr. Healy. Firstly, for the benefit of the listeners, could you give us a bit about your background and how you came to be interested in making medicine safer for all?
Okay, well, I've always been interested in people and trying to work out why we behave the way we do. And that's what led me into the mental health field. In terms of trying to make medicines safer for all, that goes back a long way, I guess. Both of my parents, at various different points, were exposed to different drugs which caused them problems. Now, they caused them the problems that the drugs were known to cause. But still, you know, I got to see at a fairly early age, long before I actually went into medicine, the impact that a treatment can have for the bad. More generally, since there's been a growing kind of awareness on my part that treatment-induced death has come close to being the modal form of death. That is, the things the health services do to you, principally the drugs they give you, have become one of the leading causes of death these days, and perhaps even the leading cause of death. And these treatments are also a huge source of morbidity and ill health, so that even if you're not killed, you may be left injured or crippled or having to cope with problems afterwards. All too often within the mental health field, you'll find that the treatment has become the illness that the services then try to treat by giving you more treatment. So all of these things were, I guess, things that grew on me fairly gradually. One of the other aspects to it is this, which is that I'm slightly stubborn, I guess. And way back in the early 1990s, when I gave SSRIs first to a few people and saw them become more anxious on them, become very agitated, and in fact, become suicidal, it was interesting to chart this and see the problems happen when people have been put on the drugs and see the problems clear up when the drugs were halted, and then find that when you try to say to other people in the field that, you know, these drugs can cause problems, that the reaction was, no, they can't. And the more I said, well, look, you know, I'm really not saying they cause everyone a problem, but they can cause problems, the reaction was, no, they can't. And when I'm faced with that kind of thing, that's the kind of thing that makes me stubborn, I guess, and likely pull the opposite way and say, well, look, you know, what I'm seeing in front of my own eyes is what I'm seeing, and I'm not going to be argued out of it. And the other aspect then to that is, why do people get so defensive on these issues, and why does the field try to act like these things can only do good? It's a very self-defeating thing for doctors to do, in that if the drugs only work well and they come free of, and they're actually free of any problems, then it's a lot cheaper for the health services to get nurses to prescribe them, or pharmacists, and maybe in due course to get robots to prescribe them. Doctors are doing themselves out of a job if they don't recognize that these drugs can be tremendously tricky, that in fact they're poisons, and that the art of medicine is to bring good out of the useful poison.
Thank you. And can I ask how you came to set up Data-Based Medicine and what the goals of the group are?
Well, the goals of the group are closely linked to the things I've just been trying to outline to you there now, which is, I think each of us who are actually involved in it had the sense that there are issues here that are of interest, that the field seems to be paying no heed to it. In the case of quite a few of the people linked to databasemedicineandrisk.org, there's people who've been injured by drugs, who've lost loved ones, and that's provided a driving force. One of the other aspects to it all is this, though. In the course of getting databasemedicineandrisk.org off the ground, it's become clear to me that whatever I know about drugs and things like that is only a fraction of what people generally know about drugs or what they can find out. And you don't have to go to university. You don't have to have a background in healthcare. You can be a person who dropped out of school early and knew nothing about these things. And pretty quickly with the internet these days, if something goes wrong for you and you've got the motivation to find out what's actually happening, you can become more expert on the fact that SSRIs work on this serotonin receptor or that serotonin receptor than even me, who've done a PhD on these things. So this has led me to the recognition that actually motivation counts for more than expertise, and that the role for a person like me should be much more in the area of helping people do the research that they're keen to do. You know, when they come back to me with a whole range of options, the one thing that I can often do is say, well, look, these options that you've outlined here look more promising leads than the other ones over there. But the idea that I should be trying to tell them, you know, that we know what's going on here, when with all these drugs, we know one or two of the things that the drugs may do, but there's a whole bunch of actions that these drugs have that we haven't been told about. And there are things that, you know, that people, if they have the motivation to go out and explore these things a bit more, can find these things out and can make the job for me, for instance, much more interesting and much more fun. So it's a case of trying to turn things around so that generally people are working together more than they are at the moment.
Well, I can certainly attest that RISC.org, your website, is one of the first places that I will look if I want to find up-to-date, unbiased information on prescription drugs and adverse effects. It's a site that I regularly recommend to others, and I thank you for providing the service. I just wanted to ask about the current state of play in the UK. There's been a worrying increase in the number of antidepressants prescribed in the UK to 63 million items in a single year. I just wanted to know what your thoughts were on what was driving that increase.
I think the principal driver here is the fact that there's a bunch of people on these drugs and a growing group of people who aren't able to get off them. It's not that we're putting more people on them each year. We're putting the same number of people on them each year. But every year, there's a proportion of those people that aren't able to get off them. And this is what's leading to the growing total year on year.
Thank you. I also wanted to ask, in any healthcare setting, there's a relationship between the drug manufacturer, the regulator, the doctor, and the patient. Do you think that relationship is working effectively in the UK?
No, I don't. I think it's working reasonably well for those of us who have any kind of pension that's linked to the share price of any of the companies that make the drugs. I think people get a bit misled about the regulator. That's the MHRA in the UK or the FDA over in the United States. The regulator is just a bureaucrat. They're not really people who know a great deal about medicine or about healthcare, about giving drugs or the kinds of problems drugs can cause. They're really in there keeping an eye on the paperwork and checking the claims the pharmaceutical companies make and saying, look, yes, you can make that claim and no, you can't make that claim. That's really all they're doing. The people who are supposed to be keeping you and me safe from the 1960s onwards were doctors. And this is why these drugs are available on prescription only. People like me, it was thought, were more skeptical about what these drugs can do than the average person out in the street. So that when people came into us and said, look, you know, I think I need this, this, and this, that we'd say to them, no, you don't. Actually, you know, these things may not actually be helpful, that, you know, you have the kind of condition that's probably going to get well anyway, so just hang on in there. Yeah. We have a situation where the pharmaceutical companies have been able to play on doctors to the point where increasingly we operate in the kind of situation where the people who come in from the street are more wary about drugs than the doctors handing them out. Again and again, you find that people come in and they're reluctant to take these pills, but they find doctors forcing them on them. So I think the people in here who failed us mostly have been doctors, and they, you know, they don't really have much to defend themselves with, in that we are highly paid people with a comfortable life and status and things like that. And I guess the expectation people had was that in exchange for that, we'd be prepared to ensure that patients aren't harmed by the things we do, or at least aren't at undue risk of being harmed.
Thank you. Talking a little bit more about potential harm to patients, what can be done, in your view, to improve the safety of the prescribing of psychoactive prescription drugs?
One thing to bear in mind here is it's not just drugs used within the mental health field that you need to be concerned about. We've recently, just in the last while, had some drugs released for asthma and drugs released for skin problems that can cause people to become suicidal and hostile and have birth defects. And equally, there's a bunch of physical problems that the drugs like the antidepressants cause. The idea that there's a group of drugs that work just on the brain and not on the rest of the body, and then a bunch of drugs that work elsewhere in the body and don't have effects on the brain, is really all wrong. That anything you take can potentially have an impact on how we behave, and any drug we're taking, which is in theory aimed at our being able to alter our behavior, can have a huge impact throughout the rest of the body.
Well, this is clearly a much wider issue than just the drugs used to treat mental health. But focusing specifically on mental health for a moment, in an ideal world, what would mental health treatment look like?
Well, this is a huge question. First of all, I think a key thing you've got to tease out is we've got to distinguish between the distress people can have and a disease. And the best way to try and bring this out is that in the case of people who've got schizophrenia, this is a chronic and enduring psychosis. People may be hearing voices, they may have strange thoughts, strange beliefs and things of that, which endure for years and years and years. And it means that they often aren't able to work hard, they aren't able to live the kind of lives that they would have otherwise lived. Now, if we just tease this out a bit, if people are under extreme stress, they can hallucinate, they can have strange ideas and things like this, they can essentially, in quotes, go mad. But often when the stress is lifted, the problems that may even have been severe enough to mean that they ended up having to go into a mental health unit, they lift and clear. On the other hand, we have a group of people who have an enduring problem that goes on for years and years and years. It's not a thing that seems to lift and clear. What I think's going on here is that under extreme stress, we can all become anxious, we can become miserable, we can become nervous, we can become obsessive, and we can even become psychotic. But these are all features of becoming extremely distressed. On the other hand, when these things endure, it'll often be the case that there's something else that's happened to us that's leading to the condition being chronic, and this is the disease bit. And in the case of something like perhaps schizophrenia, this is a disorder that hasn't been there for all time. It's only been there since about 1800. It rose in frequency during the 19th century. It may be declining in frequency now. There seems to be something about the condition, which means that some people end up with vulnerable brains. And when they become highly anxious and possibly psychotic, rather than the thing clearing up, it endures. And the kind of vulnerabilities here are probably something to do with the fact that people during the 19th century and 20th century were much more likely to be poisoned by lead in the air we breathe and in the food we eat and things like that and the water we drink than people ever were before, are there were changes in the way we did obstetrics, so that a whole load of babies got born in a way that they hadn't had the opportunity to be born before, with the introduction of general anesthesia during the middle of the 19th century. This meant that people were able to fish babies out of the womb that wouldn't have ever been able to survive before. So there's things like this that potentially have left some people with vulnerable brains, so that when they become psychotic, the thing doesn't clear up, it endures. Now, the treatment of a thing like that then is very, very different in the sense of what you're looking at is trying to prevent the kinds of conditions that could make our brains vulnerable. Okay. Doing things like ensuring that we reduce the ambient lead around the place, or looking at the contribution that obstetrical care and things like that may be making to risks of going on to get a chronic psychosis.
Well, I can certainly see the benefit of upfront intervention instead of trying to fix resulting symptoms down the line with medications that cause their own issues. In terms of our listeners, is there any general advice that you would give to a patient who is considering withdrawing from an antidepressant?
Yes. First of all, there appear to be a group of people who are able to halt the antidepressants without too much problems. Hmm. And if you're a little bit younger and you're male, it seems to be easier than if you're female and a little bit older. Curiously, this can often be reversed. Taking the antipsychotics, it can seem to be men who seem to have greater problems trying to get off them. While there are people that are able to get off both groups of drugs, either the antidepressants or the antipsychotics, there's also a very large number of people who are going to have some problems. And when I say a very kind of large number of people, I mean over half of the people who've been on an antidepressant for more than a few weeks are going to have some kind of problems. They'll have altered dream, altered sleep. They'll be more anxious. They'll be depressed, nervous. They'll feel funny and odd and tired and fatigued and things like this in a way that they hadn't been doing before. And the big risk there is that either they'll think, or their GP will think, look, this is just the underlying illness that we were trying to treat before, and you need to continue taking the pills. When in fact, this is a feature of withdrawal. And it's a thing that was noted in healthy volunteer trials of these drugs back in the 1980s. That is, when the drugs were given to people who had no nervous problems at all, and they took them for 2 weeks, over 50% of the healthy volunteers had problems that might lead a GP to say, oh, well, look, you're depressed and you need to take one of these antidepressants. So of the 50% or so of people who have problems when they begin to withdraw, there's then a group who will be able to get off. It isn't absolutely clear whether the best approach is to taper extremely slowly or just to go cold turkey, but either way, there's a bunch of people who take either of these approaches who are going to have significant problems and problems that can go on for months afterwards. And then there's a further group of people who simply can't get off at all. The difficulties they'll have trying to reduce even extremely slowly are so severe that they just can't stop at all. The problem we have at the moment, I think, is that neither you nor I can tell the Department of Health how big each of these groups is. You know, we don't know how many hundreds of thousands of people that we're actually talking about here, but you know, they are large groups.
Well, what you're saying resonates with my experience of talking with my GP. They had no idea that withdrawal was possible, and they were insistent that it was a return of my original depression and anxiety. On a more positive side, in recent times, I have heard more in the media and in the press about recognizing that dependence is a potential where prescription medications are concerned. Do you think, Dr. Healy, there's enough research on this?
No, I don't think there is. I don't know of any research on this. It would be great because, I mean, I've been hunting pretty actively to try and hook up with groups who can try to explain just why these things happen, with a view to be able to work out, well, what is it we can do that can make the withdrawal process a little bit easier? And I'm not aware of any groups working in this area, which is really curious in that if you go back to 1966, the field was within the mental health field, and in particular within that bit of it that looked at what these pills can do, what the good things are and what the risks could be. There was a very clear recognition back then that both the antipsychotics and the antidepressants could cause profound dependence and withdrawal problems. So there's some recognition that these issues are real. That's been there for over 50 years, but I'm really not aware of anyone getting to grips with just what the cause of this is and what we can do to try and help people.
Thank you. And is there anything else that you think we should make listeners aware of?
Not really. I think the big thing really perhaps is that they shouldn't be turning to the experts for the answers here, because the experts have been involved in the hiding of the problem. Mm. That people need to, if they figure they're actually having problems, they need to trust their own instincts, and they need to begin to work on the issues and hook up with people who are out there who are in the same position they're in, with a view to seeing can generally, collectively, we move things forward.
Thank you, Dr. Healy. And I wanted to thank you on behalf of all the listeners for all of your work to make medicine safer and for the personal efforts you've made to support people who have been harmed by their medications. You're one of the leading lights of this movement, and that deserves huge respect and gratitude. I'm so grateful to David for talking with me. It was an honour to be able to speak to someone with such vast experience in this area.
Feedback.
Thank you for all of your messages of support for this podcast and for the guests we've had, including Professor Reed, Claire, Giovanna, Professor Gersher, Daryl, Dr. Lynch and Dr. Healy. I wanted to share the following story with you that was emailed to me.
In 1997, I was put on antidepressants after suffering panic attack. I visited my GP and she said that I had a chemical imbalance in my brain that could be corrected with medications. She also likened antidepressants to a diabetic needing to take insulin and said that I would probably need to take them for life. There was no warning about side effects or withdrawal difficulties at all. I trusted her diagnosis and remained on them for 8 years. In 2005, I decided to stop my antidepressant as I had put on weight and I felt my personality had changed, that I was less caring somehow. I was still experiencing panic attacks, although less frequently. I was advised by a different GP to decrease the dose by taking half a tablet, waiting a few weeks and taking half again. Within a few months, I had reduced to 5 milligrams, so then I stopped completely. The withdrawal effect started with flu-type symptoms and electric shocks in my head, but I quickly descended into a hell that words cannot justify. I had never suffered with depression before, but I was plunged into a hopeless pit of despair. I had unrelenting anxiety symptoms and I was unable to sit still, which I now know is called akathisia. My balance was dreadful. I was dizzy all the time, had ringing in my ears, and I suffered terrible headaches, nausea, bowel problems, flu-like symptoms and sweating. I could not eat as the anxiety was so bad, resulting in dramatic weight loss. I experienced 10 years of this. Some days were better than others, but I never felt right and my quality of life suffered greatly. I am 12 years off now, but still suffer with balance problems, bowel and stomach issues, headaches and tinnitus. I have seen many doctors over this time, but many have been dismissive, not accepting that my symptoms could possibly be related to antidepressants. One or two have agreed that there are withdrawal effects, but can offer no help or prognosis. The result is that I am basically alone with these problems and living in hope that my situation will improve. If I could go back to my initial anxiety problems, I would gladly swap. My quality of life was far better back then. If anyone is thinking of starting antidepressants, I would encourage them to think long and hard as they ruin my life.
Thank you so much for sharing that. I think it's vital that we use our experiences to inform others that may be listening. I also want to mention some websites that are well worth your time. As we talk about in the interview with Dr. Healy, you can visit risk.org, which is rxisk.org, to research adverse effects, check medication interactions, and much more. Dr. Healy also has a personal website located at davidhealy.org. I'd also just like to share this with you that was posted on the website Surviving Antidepressants. Dear James, wow, I'm so excited to listen to this. Thank you so very much for doing this work. I think one of the many challenges in withdrawal is that the struggle is very much invisible to most of the public. Your work is going to help change that. I'm very grateful. Well, thank you so much, and keep your feedback and comments coming. And also, if you like this podcast, please rate us on iTunes and leave a review. Reviews of the podcast are really important to help get more people listening. Leaving a review takes just 5 minutes, but makes a big difference to the awareness of all the issues around psychiatric medications. Finally, if you're struggling with withdrawal yourself and don't know where to turn, there are some excellent resources listed on my website, jfmoore.co.uk. Please go and have a look.
Please do not increase, decrease, or stop your psychoactive prescription medication without the advice and support of a medical or mental health professional.
Thank you. As ever, I'm really grateful for all of your support. And until next time, take care.
Thank you so much for listening to Let's Talk Withdrawal. Come back next week for more news and views. If you enjoyed this podcast, please leave a review and subscribe in iTunes.